From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today we have a great show. But before I describe the show, let me just warn you, it's going to be a little bit different. You know, on this show, we are building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. So a few months back, I am at this fundraiser for the military, for Rough Healing Heroes, and I'm sitting at the table with this very interesting gentleman and his wife, very generous people, and they stood out to me, one, because they were car buffs and, you know, they were supporting the military. But then I realized that Stephen Kuntz is, I guess you're the CEO of the California Automobile Museum, and I have been there a few times and been so impressed. And I think the conversation led to, hey, why don't you come on the show? We got to let Sacramento know about this. I don't know if it's the best kept secret, but I didn't know about it until the last couple of years. And so I figured, let's get Stephen on the show to talk cars a little bit. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Well, thank you, Mark. You're right. Some people say the Auto Museum is one of Sacramento's best kept secrets. We're at 2200 Front Street. It's down just across the street. Across the street from the animal shelter. I tell people, come on down, go to the museum and take home a puppy. We get a lot of visitors from around the world, but a lot of people from Sacramento come in and go, I didn't know this was even here.
It's amazing. And so if you don't know where Front Street is, think old Sacramento. Right. So it's kind of like not in the heart of old Sacramento where you're going through and doing the shopping. It's a little bit off the beaten path, almost like in a little industrial area. And as you're coming by the building, you see a nice parking lot and this what looks a little bit more industrial. I haven't been over there for 6 to 12 months, but I was over there with my buddy who was having an event, and I got to speak at the event, and I'm like, this place is incredible. It's filled with cars, old classic cars and very vintage stuff, which we'll talk a little bit about, but also there's an event area. So if you are a business that is looking to do a business event or maybe a company party or something like that, this place is incredible because not only do you have this really cool event space, but you have the, I guess, additional benefit of having a car collection that is off the charts, like hundreds of cars. How many cars you guys got over there?
We have about 150 cars.
Okay.
We own about a third of them. The other two-thirds are owned by private individuals who pay us a fee for displaying them there. We have an exhibits committee and a board of directors who kind of decide what we exhibit. And we have had an increasing number of people who want to exhibit their cars there. So we really get to pick and choose among the best of the best.
Okay, are you out of room then? And because there's one area that's devoted to, let's say, looking at cars. There's another area that I know that I was in that was devoted to like having a party, having an event, speaking or something.
Right. We have the large event space we call the Alhambra Room, which you can seat up to about 300 people for dinner. We have a smaller, we call the Education Center, which you could seat about 50 people, smaller room for meetings and that kind of thing. It is becoming a challenge because we have about 150 cars. And while we want to have as many as we can, it's also how do you display them best? How do you tell the story of what they are? Because while we do a lot of our income does come from events, we are primarily an education institution. We are there to educate people about the history of the automobile and about its place in culture and the extent we can, how that relates to the local environment, you know, Sacramento and Northern California.
Okay, well, I want to dive into that in a second, but as long as we're talking about the facility itself, mm-hmm. we might as well dive a little bit deeper in this. So the facility itself How many square feet is it total? 50,000, 100,000?
No, we're 72,000 square feet.
Okay.
It was originally built as a grocery warehouse back in the late 40s. And it's been a number of things since then. And I don't know if you want to go into the history of the place, but we originally leased the building from the city, and there was some interesting history, but eventually they sold it to us for a nominal sum about 7-8 years ago. And since then, we've replaced the roof and done a number of other improvements. And we continue to improve the place.
And you're actually a nonprofit, yes, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so this nonprofit, you run this, and you have a board of directors that helps oversee this. And you've got an extensive background. You are an attorney by trade. I know you did business law, among other things. So you've got this sort of executive background, and you're retired, and you decided to take on this project. Why this project?
Well, I retired in 2012. I was a bankruptcy attorney for 30 years. Retirement is one of those things where you don't know what you're going to do till you get there. And, what you think you may want to do isn't necessarily what you will do. But in 2014, I took the docent training class. We have probably the best automotive docent training class in the country.
Now, a docent is somebody who's like an aficionado and can train on this subject?
Well, a docent is somebody specifically who interprets the exhibits for people. So typically our docents work twice a month, 3-hour shifts. They wear little blue vests. So you come in there and typically somebody will ask you, do you want a tour? And they can take you around and tell you all about the cars, tell you lots of interesting stories. But to do that, you've got to take this 4.5-month, 100-hour class, which, by the way, we start in January. So if anybody out there is interested, it doesn't cost much. But you go through this once a week, 100-hour class for 4.5 months. And at the end of that, you are a docent. We have about 150 to 200 active volunteers. And that's one of the things that, from my observation, going around the country and around the world, going to auto museums, we are a little different because we are primarily a volunteer-driven organization. We have a staff of about 10, so much of the creative process is driven by volunteers and our exhibits manager who oversees them.
Okay, so you mentioned that people want to have their cars there. So there's, mm-hmm. Talk me about that. So I get the event space. So you can rent the smaller room that holds about 50 or the bigger one that holds like 300 people. And then when you go to use the event, you get to walk through the museum, which is in one part of it. So you're walking through these 150 cars, and there's a story to be told as you're walking through. But thinking about that, do you automatically get to walk through the museum just because you rented the space? Is that kind of the...
Usually that's the process. And you would have to talk to our events person about the specifics. But generally, we do allow our guests to be in the museum, even if they're just renting the, like the Alhambra Room or the Event Center. But we have people stationed around to make sure nobody messes with the cars.
Yeah, I felt that I was watched a little bit when I was in there walking through. And, they're keeping an eye on you. Don't want you to take your alcohol too close to vehicles and so on. But it was a blast. And, it really, so when I met you, it was like, I gotta tell you the story. Because what happens when you walk through a collection like you have, it makes you go back in time. So for me, I think we all, you mentioned culture. So I want to talk a little bit about how automobiles have kind of shaped America's culture. You mentioned that it shaped Sacramento's at some level as well, which I was unaware of. But I just remember where I was, like when I was beginning to think about cars. I'm coming up, in my teenage years, and I'm in high school and kind of hoping I get a car and saving up money and dreaming about all that. And, for me, I never got the car of my dreams, but it was still almost like romanticized about, you know, having this really cool car that you could, you know, go out on dates with. And back then, drive-ins were popular, and so you'd take your girlfriend out to the drive-in movies, and it was more, I feel like it was almost like more romantic back then than it is today. But I don't know if that's true or not, because I'm not really specifically a car aficionado, you know?
Well, you know, I think there has been a cultural shift. And we talk about this. But just by the way, what was your dream car?
My dream? I actually have it now.
Okay.
So I have a little bit of a car collection. We are, some people that know me know I built this 10-car garage that to hold vehicles. And so I've got a few vehicles in there. So my dream car, though, was a Nova. Right. So probably like 68 Nova.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I had a Buick Skylark. Right. So instead of a Nova, I ended up with a Buick Skylark, which was cool. I mean, I was happy. It got me around. It mm-hmm. got me to the drive-in and I had a lot of fun. And, you know, it went as fast enough to get me a lot of speeding tickets. But the Novas were always so much cooler, right? They were just because you have those nice rims and tires, the TA radials. And I have that now. It's black and it's got that, you know, purr to it.
Sure,
and I love it. I also have a 68 Camaro convertible, which wasn't really a dream car, but I found it at August Nights, I don't know, 20 years ago, and ended up coming home with it. So I've got a few of those type cars laying around. Not laying around.
yes.
Not almost collecting dust. How about you? What was your dream car?
Well, you know, when I met my wife 50 years ago this year, we were just out of high school. Her parents had given her a 1973 Mustang Mach 1 for her high school graduation. So that was
maybe if I would have had better grades, I could have got something like that.
Or a father who was a car dealer.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, your wife's had a Mercedes dealership.
Yes,
a large one.
Her father founded the first Mercedes dealership in Orange County. And that was always kind of interesting. We started dating in 73, 74. I would go meet her at her father's dealership in Buena Park, House of Imports. And you go in the showroom and here's these 450 SLCs, $15,000. Who could afford a $15,000 car? My God, you know, a Mustang.
Now, SL, is that like a convertible?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was kind of the top of the line, the SLC, which was a convertible slash coupe. I just remember looking at those and thinking, wow, that's
a whole
different world.
How come she got afforded not a Mercedes?
Because her father was smart.
Oh, yeah, we're trying to keep her happy, right?
Yeah, we'll try to keep her from, you know, not costing him a lot of money.
Oh, okay, you know? Gotcha. Okay, go ahead, back to your dream car. And so your wife, your girlfriend at the time, she had a really nice Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, I wasn't really that much into cars until I think it was a combination of things. You know, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the gas crises of the 70s,
mm-hmm.
you know,
being 70, in line.
73, 75. And then, of course, you had emission controls and all that going on. And so we both thought by the time we were old enough and had enough money to have a nice car, it would be something old. Because the new cars were terrible.
Oh.
Because
of the emission controls.
Well, the emission controls, well, you figure a Corvette. In 1970, you could buy a 450-horse Corvette. By 73, 74, 190 horse. I mean, everything just went downhill. The 5-mile-an-hour bumpers, all that stuff. But then, of course, the Japanese cars came in and there was a glimmer of hope there. But that's a whole nother story, as it were. I actually teach the history of the Asian car market in our docent training courses. So I'm kind of aficionado of the Japanese cars.
Don't you feel like I'm not an aficionado on the Japanese. I'm not an aficionado on any of it, but I'm more intrigued by what I'll call the muscle car. Anybody
sure.
who might not know that, that's an American-made car that was kind of masculine, I think, in some level. And I guess that's why they called it the muscle car. And you had a muscle car and, you know, you were cool, right?
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting, the history of those. The GTO, Pontiac GTO, is generally considered the first muscle car. And that was a project by John DeLorean. He was the youngest head of a GM division ever, or at the time anyway. And he saw that you had all these young people coming up, baby boomers we call them now, who had money. That was what the Mustang, of course, was aimed at. That was called a secretary's car. It was aimed at young people who wanted something that looked kind of cool but really didn't have all that much power. Well, DeLorean went the other way. He broke GM rules on the size of engines and basically stuffed a big engine in a Pontiac Tempest. They called it the GTO because Ferrari had a model called the GTO, which they had not trademarked, and that became the first muscle car.
Mid-60s?
Yeah, 64, 63, 64. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, within a couple of years, everybody started doing that. In 1965, Ford partnered with Shelby, Carroll Shelby, mm-hmm. To turn the Mustang into a race car. That became the GT350. Famously, Carroll Shelby said, well, you can't turn a mule into a racehorse, but he figured out how to turn the Mustang into a race car. The rest was history. But then, of course, GM came out with the Camaro to compete with the Mustang, and then everybody else started doing muscle car versions. And for a couple of years, they all got away with it. But eventually, the insurance companies started seeing, you know, you got these young guys, a lot of them coming home from Vietnam, buying these overpowered cars and getting in accidents.
Okay. Well, you think about, like, the rest of pop culture at the time and even today, but I'm thinking more, I grew up in the 70s.
Sure.
And the music and the movies and the commercials on TV, you know, back then there was only, you know, three television channels. It wasn't the choices. So you didn't have this watered down, you know, content coming to you, you know, this huge variety. You got hammered over and over. So let's talk music for a second. So music of the, you know, I'm thinking Beach Boys and
Jan and Dean.
Yeah, Jan and mm-hmm. Dean. And even as you get into a little bit later, mm-hmm. they're still talking about, one of the songs that I used to love is called Chevy Van, right? So it's this making love in a Chevy Van. I love that. So I still have it. It's on my playlist. But these things that made you think about how cool it was to have the right vehicle.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, you think about the differences between then and now. Of course, there's no internet. There was no, you know, if you wanted to talk to people, you had to go talk to them or else get them on the phone and your parents would yell at you for being on the phone too long. So communication was much more personal. And I think, too, getting your driver's license at 16, which here in California anyway is 16, was a rite of passage. And
Freedom,
that's right. And everybody that I knew anyway wanted to got their license as soon as they could. And often parents, you know, particularly if you're in Southern California, where you've got to drive everywhere, the parents want you to be out and driving yourself around.
I hear kids these days, you know, you got to get your driver's license. Oh, you know, maybe sure. Because you can Uber. There's other ways to get around. And for whatever reason, maybe mm-hmm. they have enough freedom already. But I wanted to get out of the house and I wanted to go
sure.
visit friends and, you know, drive fast and be on the open road. It was just, I mean, I dreamt about it. It was like a stay up, you know, I couldn't sleep at night when I knew I was getting ready to turn 16 because I was so excited.
Yeah. I think that kids were much more dedicated to being independent then. You know, when I think about when we got married very young. I was still in college. Then we moved up here for me to go to law school. We never looked back. Wanted to do our own life as soon as we could. Most of the kids I know of my friends who are now in their 20s and 30s, the kids are not nearly as independent. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just I think that with the internet and social media and all that, it's just there isn't the incentive to get out and be in the bigger world. for a lot of them.
I think there's movies too. You know, movies have glamorized the idea of having a cool car, whether it be James Bond, the Batmobile, right? Is a sort of a famous car, and Back to the Future. I used to own some video stores, so I remember Love Bug. You know, things like that. These are like part of like what the movies are about. So
right.
I have to imagine that that's when people walk through the museum, they start having those memories like I'm describing.
Sure. And that is one of the things that's unique about us. Many museums, like you go to the Peterson or the Blackhawk in Danville, they have the cream of the crop, you know, the rarest of the rare, you know, untouchable kind of cars. We have cars that people actually lived with, you know, everything from the Model T, the Model A, the early Fords, to the, you know, the cars, the GM and Ford and Chrysler going up through the 60s. It's so many times I'll be giving people tours, and I'm also one of the docents there. So, you know, I get to be out on the floor talking to people. So many times people say, oh, that was my first car, or my dad had that car.
Interesting.
And I think that that's a big draw.
Was there a certain car, or is there a certain car maybe that's in your museum that is kind of like the nerd car, right? It's the one that you're like, oh, God, I hope I don't have a Pacer or something like that. Do you have a Pacer in the car?
Yes, we do.
Do you?
Yes, and actually, 2 years ago.
I'm sorry if you had a Pacer. You're not a nerd, right?
Right. Well, Pacer, you know, this is the other thing is that all of these cars have a story, and you might look at something and go, oh, that's really ugly. But then if you know the story.
Right.
So, for instance, the Pacer was built by AMC, which is now long been out of business. But this was built in the early 70s when they were trying to build small cars. It was also built during a time when Mazda had just started building the Wankel rotary engine cars. You may remember in the early 70s, you could buy Mazdas, almost all of them, in the rotary engine.
Yeah, I remember that was the big advertisement. Yes. I had an RX-7 I got my next car was an RX-7. Really cool little sports car. But so rotary engines, they're not part of what happens these days.
No, because, well, there's a lot of reasons, but in the late 60s, early 70s, everyone in the auto industry thought they were going to be the next big thing. GM spent $50 million developing a rotary engine, and what was going to happen, the plan was that GM was going to build these rotary engines, AMC was going to buy them and put them in the Pacer. Well, because, you know, the Pacer is a short, squat little car, and rotary engines are very, very compact for their power. When GM pulled the plug on that process, they never built rotary engines. AMC was left with a fairly clunky six-cylinder that they had to put in them, and that contributed to their, you know, they're not doing very well. Nobody ever built rotary engines except for Mazda in terms of automotive commercial applications. They are no more, and there's you know, lots of reasons for that. The primary ones being the fuel economy. I mean, they're great. If you had an RX-7, you know what I'm talking about. They're smooth, very high power.
I landed my wife in that car. That's where she saw the RX-7. It's like, okay, she couldn't say no.
But what was the mileage like?
I have no idea, but not good though.
I had one of the last RX-8s built, and it was a wonderful car. But, you know, we have a 09 AMG SL, Mercedes AMG SL, which has got a 6.3 liter, 520 horse V8. It gets better mileage than this RX-8, which had a 87 cubic inch engine. I mean, tiny Crazy. Little thing, but a 230 horse out of that.
Yeah. Now, if you don't know what these are, they're like little sports cars, and they're cool. Yeah. They did, you know, like little two-seaters or four-seaters, you know, you get a small back seat.
Yeah, the RX-8 was a four-passenger, all-aluminum body, very cool car. But, you know, they quit building them in 2012, and Mazda keeps hinting they're going to build another one, but I don't think they will. Just be the mileage, the fuel economy. They also meter oil into the engine to seal, if you don't know what a rotary engine is, instead of having pistons, it has these little triangular rotors that spin, but they have to use oil in order to keep the edges of it sealed. So they go through a quarter of oil every 600-700 miles. So that oil has to go somewhere, and it's out the back black tailpipe. So that's been a challenge for the emissions.
What's the most popular car you have in the museum?
Well, we do have several. I call them jewels of the collection. We do have a DeLorean, which everyone loves because of the Back to the Future movies. Mm-hmm. Did you see the movie Ford versus Ferrari?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's that opening scene in Riverside where Ken Miles is driving that white Cobra, and where he threw a wrench at Carroll Shelby and broke the windshield. We have that
right,
car.
Right. The story is their adversaries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have that car. The stunt driver was a local guy, Tony Hunt, and he bought the car from the production company at the end of the movie. He has it at the museum. And so we have a little clip of the movie going with the car. We also have an original Shelby 427 Cobra that was owned by Tony Hogue, who was the longtime editor of Road and Track. And the interesting story with the Shelby cars, you know, Carroll Shelby was a very successful race car driver. And when he found out he had a heart condition in the early 60s, he decided he was going to build cars. So he bought a little aluminum roadster from a company called AC in England and stuffed a Ford V8 in it. And that became the original Shelby Cobra. Well, if you take all of the Shelby Cobras, the 260, 289, and the 427s, there's only about 1,000 of them ever built. And so they're all worth, in fact, the 427s, I think they're 321, something like that, that were built. And so whenever you see somebody driving down the street in one of those, they're replicas because the original's all worth millions of dollars. And we have one of them in the museum. And this one is very special because of its connection with Road and Track. And for me, I started reading Road and Track in about 1975 when the editor, Tony Hogue, owned the car. And so he'd write articles about how difficult it was to drive, how his wife wanted to drive it, so he disconnected half the carburetion so she wouldn't kill herself. And so now we have the car in the museum. It's kind of cool.
That is cool.
Now, the most valuable car we own, you would be rather surprised, and it's always kind of surprising to tell people. You may remember the GM EV1. That was GM built this electric vehicle in, it was about 92.
I do not remember that.
They were sold. They were leased through Saturn dealers in California and Arizona. So it was like their first experimental EV. And they, like I said, they leased them. At the end of the leases, they took them all back and crushed them. And people were outraged. In fact, they made a movie, Who Killed the Electric, it was called Who Killed the Electric Car. And it was about the EV1 and how GM decided they didn't want them coming out. And so they destroyed them all. But the reality was it was an experiment. They had heavy lead acid batteries. They're not really comparable to modern electric cars. And when they were done with the experiment, they didn't want them out there for warranty claims.
They didn't want to have to support the
They didn't
car,
want to have yeah. to support it. So there's about 30, 40 of them left in the world.
That's why it's so valuable, is there's very few.
That's right, because there's very few of them. Actually, I understand that the only one that GM was not able to retrieve from the public was Francis Ford Coppola would not give his up. And so he has it running around his estate.
That's awesome.
But so, that's an always an interesting car to tell people about.
Did I see cars that were maybe like Jeeps from the military? Because I keep thinking about, you know, my son being in the military. You and I were at an event that was in support of military.
Yes.
And thinking about how automotive and our advancements in the U.S., you know, being so strong in automotive, how that may have given us an advantage from a military standpoint. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I mean, if you think about, let's say, World War II, we were the arsenal of democracy, as was called at the time. We were the largest industrial company, a country in the world. And certainly the Jeep was a big part of our mobilization during the war. And the Jeep is an interesting story. We have a World War I Jeep. World War II Jeep. We also have a Barbie Jeep.
There's a contrast there.
Yes. Well, I think it was the early 60s. Henry Kaiser of Kaiser Steel. He bought a hotel in Hawaii, and he wanted to have some Jeeps for the hotel. So he had Willys build a bunch of pink and blue and white Jeeps with these Surrey fringe tops. And we have one of the pink ones. And boy, this year, since that Barbie movie came out, it's been a real hit.
Get my granddaughter over there. But then you have a World War II Jeep.
Yes,
we
do have a World War II Jeep.
And so are you an aficionado or an expert in that realm and how that may have shaped the strength of our military?
Certainly our mechanization and the vehicles made a big difference, yes. As far as being a specific aficionado of that, I don't know as much as some of my docents. And that is one of the great things about that place, is that you want to know something about anything automotive, and there's somebody there that knows a whole lot. We have people that work on cars there. We have a pit crew, a road crew that takes cars out. Mm. The other thing, though, before we get too off the topic of the museum, is we do rotating exhibits. And this is one of the most important parts of the whole process. You know, think about what a museum is. It's a bunch of old artifacts that tell a story, but it's basically a static process with a lot of museums. You have, because the past doesn't change, so you have all these artifacts from the past. So how do you keep it relevant to keep people coming in the door so you can keep the doors open, mm-hmm. and how do you keep it relevant for the culture to educate people? And so we have the front of the museum, the front, say, 5,000 square feet. We do these rotating exhibits. Last year we had an exhibit of lowriders, turned out to be really fairly important, because that community got together to put together this display. We basically gave them the space and said, hey, you guys, knock yourselves out. And they created this lowrider commission, which they started meeting at the museum. And that inspired them to get together with the sheriff's department, police, and got the city to repeal its anti-cruising laws. And then that has spread around the state. It's my understanding that as of the beginning of next year, the statewide law will go away. And part of that is
I didn't even know there was... Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, and part of that was because of the people we got together for this lowrider exhibit.
Wow. Okay, so thinking back, some people might be listening going, what's a lowrider? When I was growing up, we would cruise, as you mentioned. Sorry. I didn't even know it was against the law now, but you would cruise in Sacramento. There was J Street, and then ultimately we moved. There was Sunrise Mall, which is, I don't even think, in business anymore. But there was just these, you drive around in your car. That's what you do on a Friday or Saturday night. Hey, what are you doing this weekend? Probably go cruising on Friday night, maybe Saturday night, you get a date or whatever, something like that. But that's what we did. And the lowriders were predominantly the Hispanic community, and they lowered, you know, a lot of us, I raised my car, you know, I had the air shocks, got it lifted a little bit, but the Hispanic community went in with the low riders and they had their own cool culture.
Yes.
And you don't see as many of those around anymore though today.
Well, I get maybe that depends on where you're
looking. My eyes are looking more at the Camaros and the muscle car type stuff, but these are like the boat type car. Well, like they're gigantic cars,
right,
that they've lowered.
The lead sleds.
Yeah.
That's what they call them. But yes, and the artistry that goes into those cars, the paint, the chrome work, all the body work, they're just beautiful. Real, you talk about kinetic art, and they really are that. And it's become a real family-oriented thing. These cars get passed down from one generation to the next. Yeah, there is the community is really thriving. In fact, at the inspiration of our exhibits manager, Shavola Rodriguez, we are doing another lowrider exhibit starting in January, except this one will be the women of lowriding, because apparently there is a woman, female-oriented lowrider subculture, women who own the cars and have their own community. And so she's going to head that up, bring that in.
That's cool.
But right now we have another really interesting and unexpected kind of exhibit. It's called Glamour Road. And Glamour Road is this coffee table book these two guys down in Palm Springs put together during COVID. And Tom Dole and Jeff Stork, I think Jeff is the one who, he was a longtime GM employee, had all his marketing material from all the car companies going back to the late 40s. And Tom Dole's a graphic designer. And so they came up with the interesting concept that the cars of the marketing of the cars of the 40s to the mid 60s, particularly the marketing to women, was an extension of women's fashion. And the book is full of all of these great ads from that period, and tied to the annual changes of the cars, and then how that was tied to the changes in women's fashion during that time. And so I saw this book earlier in the year. It's like, this is an exhibit. This could be very cool. We got a hold of the authors. One of our board directors, Scott Mickelson, knows Tom Dole. And they got on board. They gave us permission to use the book. And so if you go in the museum right now, there's these huge posters, which are pages out of the book, which have been blown up, all this marketing material showing how car companies were trying to market to women in the 50s. We have a 57 Dodge LaFemme, which was a Dodge that was marketed specifically to women. It's pink and it came with makeup case and all this, very sexist by today's standards. But it was, the earliest marketing attempts to women, and it's made a great, great exhibit.
And in terms of the evolution of this, so we have a lot of this static history, and you are probably asked, where do you see this industry going, I assume, over time, because now electric vehicles are, I won't say they're becoming the rage, but Tesla's right down the street, they're very popular, and I think some of the American car makers are attempting to get into the game,
sure,
at different levels with different levels of commitment. Any thoughts on how the automotive industry is going to evolve?
Well, that's real interesting, because if you think about the history of the automobile, if you were to go buy a car in 1900, only a third of the cars on the road were gasoline powered. Another third were steam powered, and the third were electric. There were more, percentage wise, there were more electric cars on the road in 1900 than there are today. Ah. They were mostly urban, because you had to have electricity in 1900. America was mostly rural. They were urban, and the buyers were mostly women, because starting a steam car or a gasoline car was very messy and noisy and dangerous and all that. An electric car was just like today, where you get in and push a little button and away you go quietly. But as far as where it goes now, it's anybody's guess. I mean, personally, I think electric cars are fine as appliances. Everyone needs a toaster, everyone needs a refrigerator or washing machine. It's just another appliance. Nobody is going to lust after, I think, electric cars once they become dominant, because underneath they're all the same. You have a battery pack and a different kind of motors, and they all are different efficiencies and all that. And even once they get past the issue of range anxiety and charging time and all that, I just don't see how, your muscle car guy, is an electric car ever going to replace that V8 rumble?
Right, I think they manufacture that sound now in some of those electrics, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Teslas have fart sounds. You can do anything you want, but it's just all surface. There's no substance to it. Who knows where the future goes? And of course, that may say something about where, automotive museums go, in 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, at some point, it's all going to be really ancient history and people will have no memories of it.
Well, they have these auto auctions. I mentioned Hot August Nights, but sure. I think there's other big ones around the country. And,
sure.
Are those as popular as they used to be? Are those dwindling?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't follow them a whole lot. But I have a few cars myself. I'm a small collector. Certainly the value of certain cars is not going down.
Okay.
The 94 NSX I have out there, I bought that for 6 years ago for $70,000. That was a lot of money at the time for one of those. I just got a quote from Hagerty that it's now $160,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it really is like buying a piece of art to a certain extent. You buy it and you hang on to it, and somebody, because they're not making any more of it, it's the value is going up.
Well, that's kind of my main interest at this point is as a collector, because they're great to drive. There's, when you drive a car like that, the best cars, it's like you are sitting in the seat of the engineers that built it. You are interpreting what they created. And, if they're doing their job right, you feel the interpretations. Like, okay, there's a reason this is here. There's a reason that the shift points are where they are. The torque curve is the way it is. All those things. It is a kind of art, but it's also something that it's the engineer passing on their creativity to the driver.
Is that your daily driver? Like, we all have these cars. Like, I drive a Toyota truck. That's my daily driver. Sure. But then I have these other cars. Nobody looks at me when I'm in the Toyota truck. I'm here in the Toyota truck. You blend so well. It's nice because you can go anywhere. No one's going to, it's basically no big deal. It's a white truck. It can get dirty. Nobody cares, right? Throw crap in the back of it. It's so utility focused that it's great. But then I get into I have a Porsche 911, right? Turbo S. Mm-hmm. You get in that car and it's not a brand new car, but people are like, oh, nice car. Or if you're in the Nova or the Camaro, one of these others, or even I would assume your NSX too. People sure. see it and they want to talk about it.
Sure, sure. I also have a 2016 Cayman S. So I know about Porsches, love Porsches. Mm-hmm. My daily drivers, I drive the Porsche almost all the time. We have a 2019 Miata. And then we have a Mercedes 450 wagon. We have dogs, so we haul the dogs around in the
Mercedes
wagon.
Mercedes 450 wagon, so it's a station wagon?
Yes.
Okay, I guess I've seen those. I just try to remember.
Well, you don't see many of them. Yeah. And then we have an Expedition, 2018 Ford Expedition, which is my wife's favorite car. She likes to drive that one.
So speaking of, that's a lot of cars. I've got quite a few. You probably have way more than I do. But where do you park them all?
We have a small warehouse down the industrial part of Rancho Cordova.
Yeah.
That was a funny thing. We spent years looking for a big house with a 10-car garage or something like that, and we just never found any houses we really liked. And then in 2012, it was still the recession, I had a friend of mine said, why don't you just buy a little warehouse?
Hmm.
And we found this bank-owned tilt up and out in the industrial part of Rancho.
Industrial properties got up in value too, so that's got up.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a, commercial broker. He says it's probably doubled in value.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a nice little place to get away, and it's got little offices and you know, areas for about six cars.
Well, I'm going to give a little shout out to my buddy now that he's making me think about it. So I have the one 10-car garage I mentioned is a detached. It's just like a big metal building, you know, on my property, and it's not fancy. It's industrial looking. And then we're building the house, and I was talking to my buddy who owns something called the Closet Doctor, Derek Holland, and he's like, you've got some nice cars. Why don't we do some really badass cabinets in there? So I have these bright red cabinets and the floor's black. And just a shout out to anybody who wants to have a garage or a place to park their vehicles that is really cool. The Closet Doctor does some really cool stuff, and that's got to be a sort of a popular thing. When enthusiasts come in, they've got a few cars and they want to have them on display at their house, I assume. Is that kind of a, like a normal thing for enthusiasts?
Yes. We have one of our directors, and I won't say who without his permission, but he has about a 30-car garage below his house in Fair Oaks. You would never even know it by passing by the house, but you walk down the stairs and here's this walkout basement with whole everything from brass era to Ferraris. He has a shop. He restores cars for Pebble Beach. And, you know, so there are a number of people around town who have collections that
they're kind of like hidden. He's got I can picture this 30-car underground thing, almost maybe slide down in a pole like you're going to the Batcave or something. It sounds kind of cool. Okay, so what did I not ask you? You know, we're running, I don't say we're running out of time, but just to make sure we don't go all day on this, what did I not ask you that probably the word needs to get out about the California Automobile Museum?
Well, we are a 501c3, and so we do depend on the charity of the public to help get us by. We do, like I say, we have the rental spaces. We do school tours. There's the docent training program. We're always looking for interesting cars and, you know, interesting communities. We do have a small area we call the Car Club Cavalcade, where different clubs come in and display cars, and some of them very old and rare. We have right now four or five Oaklands, which was the predecessor to, I think it was Pontiac, and don't quote me on that, but it's one of the long defunct car companies, and we have some of their cars from the 30s in there. So car clubs come in, we'd certainly love to have people come by and get a docent tour and tell you about the museum.
Well, that's great. Steve, I appreciate you coming on the show. Just to the Sacramento business community, there is because we're always looking for a place. As business leaders or business people, we're looking to have events that are, you know, not in the same old place. And nothing wrong with going to the convention center or some of these other, I guess, normal event centers. You go to the California Automobile Museum and you get like this special treat in addition to the event that you're already having, because virtually everybody has an interest in these old cars and the history associated with them. And if they don't, then they should get exposed to it so that they can help develop that interest and have a better understanding of the history.
Sure. It's part of our culture. You know, it's a big part of how we got here. And so if anybody is interested, contact Karen McLaughlin. She's our director, and she'd be able to talk to you more about event rentals and all that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stephen Kutz. Appreciate you sharing the story of your business with us. It's definitely different than what we would normally talk about, but so interesting, I think, to a lot of us, and appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me on. It's been a real pleasure, and glad to be able to share the museum with you.
Love it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, at Mark Haney Show, and The Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side. Yeah.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.